Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, licensed marriage. Let's start over again. Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, grandmother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, and emotion worker. And she uses all of these skills to address the subjects that we grapple with in this conversation with a reluctant therapist. Good afternoon, Elizabeth.
Good afternoon, Tyler.
That's what happens when I'm off for 2 weeks. I don't even know how to talk anymore.
We missed you last Tuesday because I had my granddaughter actually here in the studio.
Oh, how was that?
She did really well. I could only heard her a couple times say, Nana, in the back while we're in the middle of a conversation. But yeah, that was fun. I was in full Nana mode all last week and took her to Live Oak. And it's been a great weekend. But today, it's just back to my day-to-day.
Live Oak is over, so it's back to reality now.
I know, but I'm really excited because I got some great interviews, some great conversations with some of the artists that I'll be rolling out over the course of the summer when I take off on my annual road trip around the country and send back some shows from the road. So I'll be
sharing.
Where
are you going this year?
Our first journey is going to be out into Idaho, and then our journey is to Idaho. How we get there and how we come back is up in the air. My husband and I are just kind of letting the roads guide us. And then I'll be back east again because I'm always drawn, as you know, to upstate New York. There's so much that goes on. The burned out district of upstate New York to talk to the people in Lilydale and some of those places. So.
And what's in Idaho, or is that a secret?
No, it's not a secret at all. Idaho is, I have some friends there, and we're going to do some fly fishing, which I've never done before. So I have a bug net.
Okay.
And a good attitude. So that's what I'm taking
you
with me.
You and I have different very summers planned, but okay.
So I'm looking forward. But today, it's a conversation that I've been looking forward to having, and I'm glad that we were able to put it together because you may or may not know this, but one of the reasons that I became a therapist was because that I, since I was a youngster, have been drawn to having those conversations that were always considered taboo, those conversations that your grandparents and your parents always said, you never go there. You just don't talk about those things in polite company. And so, of course, I was completely drawn to conversations about politics and sex and family and relationship issues and people's health and, of course, some gossip and then religion, like always my favorite conversations. And I remember being at some event with my grandmother and asking someone something incredibly personal. I don't remember the details, but I remember the look my grandmother gave me, which was, you are dead to me. And I knew that I had crossed some sort of conversational line, but it never stopped. You know, any one of those topics on any given day will set my heart a flutter. Like, I am so excited to have someone want to open up and share with me something raw and real about who they are. So clearly I came to this profession because it gave me license to delve into and talk about these issues with people. And if I were to think about it, it's probably one of the reasons why I don't get invited to a lot of cocktail parties or dinner parties. People are afraid when I walk in the door of what I'm going to bring up. But it's interesting because according to research I saw by Pew, that half of, if not a little bit more, of adults in the United States seldom, if ever, talk about religion outside of their immediate family. And almost the exact same number of people don't talk about religion within their immediate family. But then conversely, the same poll found that people that identify themselves as highly religious, especially evangelical Protestants, like to talk about religion all the time, are very open about it. But also interestingly enough, and I don't know how all of these numbers pan out, the groups that most like to talk about religion also say that they never, 93% of them, try to dissuade or persuade people to follow their own personal religious beliefs. And that includes those who identify as atheists or agnostics also say, you know, I'm very passionate about my beliefs, but I do not try to change others. And so I consider myself religious curious. Very religious, curious. I was raised Catholic and never really didn't touch me too deeply, but I did run the folk mass at our church for all through high school, playing Day by Day from Godspell and some of those upbeat folk songs that the priest did not like having it infiltrate his service. And so my experience was sitting up in the choir loft, he and I would make eye contact right as we were getting to the part where we were supposed to start singing. And then he would start saying the prayer right as we were supposed to sing. It just never really mixed. I never really felt that welcome. And so after high school and going into college and going into my 20s, I kind of bounced around exploring different, you know, paths of faith and spirituality and doing my work at Pacifica. It's really based a lot in mythology and learning about women's spirituality. So I've done a lot of dancing in and out, but never really delved into deeply enough to have a strong sense of a religious or spiritual base, which is why I'm so excited today, because my guest in the studio actually gets paid to talk about religion. So here, you know, obviously, he's not going to be shy about talking about it. Dr. Stephen Lloyd Moffitt is a professor and program director of the Religious Studies minor at Cal Poly. And if you hear any of the talk around campus, and the students talk a lot about different professors, Dr. Lloyd Moffitt is beloved and frightened, or feared maybe in some way. He has an intimidating, intimidation is not the right word, but students have come to me often and said, there is a professor on campus who teaches religious studies, and he turned my mind upside down. He's got so much to share and so much information. And the main takeaway I had of being in his class was that we all need to believe in something, whatever that is, find something to believe in. And so after years and years of having students come in and tell me about this mystical, wonderful professor, I finally have Dr. Stephen Lloyd Moffitt in the studio today to have a conversation about that taboo subject, religion. He is world-renowned in his knowledge of the subject, and I have no direction that we're going into. We're just going to open up the microphone. We're also going to open up the phone lines today. So if you want to call in with a question, our number is 805-781-3875. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And remember, you can always get in touch with me off the air by sending an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. You can podcast our shows by visiting Apple Podcasts and search for A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. Subscribe, and the shows will be uploaded. Or you can visit kcbx.org. Tyler does a great job about getting our shows posted immediately, and you can go back all 8 years and listen to shows right there. You can also follow us on Instagram, Elizabeth_TRT, to keep up with the show, find out who my guests are, and also on Facebook. So as always, I look forward to seeing where this next hour takes us. I look forward to hearing your thoughts, and I look forward to chatting with Dr. Lloyd Moffitt. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And my guest today is Dr. Stephen Lloyd Moffitt, but I'm going to call you Steve, if that's okay.
Yeah, it's great.
Thank you for coming in.
Yeah, and thank you for providing a forum to talk about religion on air.
I know, well, because it is that taboo topic. And as I was doing some research about why religion is such a taboo topic, I came across a research study done. This psychologist had found that one of the most offensive questions you can ask someone is, what brought you to your religion? So I'd like to start with, what brought you to your religion? And is that an okay question?
Yeah. I mean, I didn't grow up thinking I would ever be a religious studies professor. As an undergrad, I studied economics and film studies. I went to go be a management consultant with Boston Consulting Group. This was not part of my mindset. I didn't have any academics in my family at all. But I think I can trace it back to I studied abroad in Greece as an undergrad. And as background, I grew up in Seattle,
okay,
and I just wanted to have sunshine. I went to school in Los Angeles at Claremont McKenna College. It was sunny. It was beautiful. When I wanted to study abroad, I wanted to go somewhere sunny, so I went to Greece. And there was an extra credit opportunity to go to this monastic peninsula in the north of Greece called Mount Athos. And it has a legendary past. There's 24 monasteries. Everybody there is a monk or a hermit. All sorts of weird stuff happens there. No woman has set foot on it for 1,000 years. When monks die, rigor mortis doesn't set in their body. There's all these legends about it. But I went because it was a free trip. And I went with a friend who called himself a recovering Catholic. And we went to the very first monastery. And we were greeted by the monk who was at the guest house. He said, "Welcome, I'm glad you're here." And he turned around, and my friend and I looked at each other and were like, "What is that?" It was like he glowed. It was like he had this immense joy that just enraptured the person. And he didn't say anything that was particularly deep, just, "Welcome, I'm glad you're here." But I felt something palpable in me that there was something there. And we looked at each other and we realized, I think even at that time, that we would never quite be the same after encountering this person. And in many ways, what I realized is I saw my first happy, truly happy person. And he was not what I expected. In other words, he didn't have a family, he didn't have a job, he didn't have a career, he didn't have social stature. He was a guest keeper at a monastery. And over the years, I've come to get to know him, actually, after that initial experience. And I came to realize that there's something there about people who take their faith so seriously. And so I came back from studying abroad. And I kind of was, you know, as 21-year-olds are, I was like, America's lied to me. They told me I should do all these things to be happy. But here is a guy who was truly happy. And so I got a job as a management consultant, but I applied for a fellowship with a guy who it's called the Watson Foundation. And it was founded by the guy who started IBM. And he had a bunch of money in the 60s, 70s. And he decided to try to identify people who he thought down the road would change America and fund their worldly experience. So you just had to have a question that was important to humanity, or at least important to you, and then stay out of the country for 14 months answering that question. So I applied and said, "Why are monks happy?" And in their foolishness, they funded that. So I spent a year going around the world living in monasteries, interviewing monks and different spiritual leaders.
And were the monasteries just open to that kind of research or?
Yeah. I mean, my experience in most religious communities, if you show a genuine interest, they're open to you. One of the advices that I give to students, if they're going to go travel in monasteries and religious ideas, is come in and see where they need help. Because the best conversations in my experience always came why doing dishes, why shelling nuts, why painting something. And so if you go in and say, "Hey, give me all your wisdom," you know, oftentimes they get kind of very closed. But, you know, hour two of washing dishes, then you get the nuggets of wisdom. And so, yeah, they were great. And it would often be the case that I would meet a hermit, for example, and spend a couple of days with a hermit. And then in the second day, they'd say, "You know, I have a friend. He doesn't see people much. But here's how you get to him. You rappel down this cliff face. You go across here. He's lived there for 32 years. You'd like him." And so oftentimes, once you made relationships, they shared new relationships with you. And you kind of went around the world that way, trying to meet interesting people. So that was, so most of my experience in religion initially was all experiential. Mm-hmm. I had been around the world and I'd met all these people. And then I had a long beard, long hair at the end of a monastic year, as you should. And I flew home, shaved everything, bought 6 suits, and bought a car, and started working a week later. And I didn't enjoy working. I really liked the company I worked for, the business I worked for. But I felt that something was amiss, that something was empty. In the end, I was kind of making money for people who already had money. And it was fun and it was interesting and well paid. I think in many ways, I saw it like a game. Every day you walked in and there was a problem and you tried to solve it with cool, interesting people. But I sensed that there was something missing. And so my roommate and I at the time decided to go on a big wanderjahr, a big journey, and we decided just to go to the tip of South America. And so we outfitted an old Land Cruiser, and we spent 10 months driving to South America. And that was our moment to try to figure out life.
And how old are you at that point?
24, 25.
Okay, so it's all happening in a pretty short amount of time.
Yeah, yeah. And it was really on that trip where I said, okay, where do I find my joy, and where do I serve society? And it occurred to me at that time that here is something that I can help the world with. I love studying religion. I never thought of it as a career before, but here's something that I can offer the world if I can go and get a PhD and do my stuff. And so I came back and left the business world and started graduate school, and spent way too much time in school for the next half decade or so.
I have to ask how your family responded to, because you said you weren't necessarily raised in a religious home. So
yeah, it's funny. No, in many ways, I grew up in a pretty customary suburban home. And I would say one of the lessons I've always taken from my father is in whatever I do, he always says, okay, how can I help? Hmm. Always. He's just always been supportive. My mom always has a bit of a harder time. And there were many conversations with her, but she comes around over time. My parents have always been super supportive of what I did. And I grew up in a household where I was always thought that I could do what I want. I could follow what my interests were. And so eventually they were supportive of it all.
So what did... I'm not sure even which direction to go, whether it's – because right now it sounds very academic that you were curious about religion, but it doesn't sound like that heart piece that opens you and a faith evolves, because the story still sounds a little bit more like you were outside looking in and
– Yeah. That's always been a tension within my life. I think in some sense I was drawn to a lot of the – extremes in religion, these people who had profound spiritual experiences. And I wanted to understand, what drove those. And if you look at my early academic stuff, it was all on mysticism. And that was my thing. I wanted to know all the mystics. And there was always this part, am I here to develop spiritually, or am I here to develop intellectually? But one of the things I think I realized on the trip down to South America was, for me, those two are going to merge in some way. That if I'm going to talk about religion, I should really know what I'm talking about. And that I felt in some senses that I could say, oh, yes, I met the Dalai Lama, or when I, saw this guru or whatever, I could talk about it. But I really didn't understand it in a deep sense. And so I felt the need to go in and understand the languages and understand the history. And I think in that process, it made me shift a lot. Because if you look at my early work, as I said, it was mostly interest in mysticism and spiritual experiences. Over time, I ended up being more and more interested in community and the importance of community as a part of a social experiment in religion. And I ended up being much more interested in sort of how we get along and how we support each other and the role religion plays in that realm.
So is your faith, your personal faith, separate from your understanding of a religious community?
So it's an interesting question, because my students always want to know what I am. And I don't say. In part, just because I don't want them to tailor their essays to what they want me to know.
Agreed.
Or what they think I want to hear from them. But also, I think if they can tell what I am, then I'm not doing a good job representing the tradition. And so there have been times where students have taken votes afterwards about what they think I am, and that's always curious to me. But I also don't want to become, I think for some people, I can kind of become a crutch in the sense of they are like, oh, you know about all the religions. You've studied them all. You picked this. Oh, this must be right. And I can say that, you know, what is right from my experiences for me likely is not right for you. I mean, certainly I develop opinions on various traditions, but I'm not sure my choices are relevant to others. And I don't want to, you know, if somebody finds a deep meaning in a tradition that I don't, you know, get or don't, you know, have a real heart towards, that's great. Mm-hmm. And so I don't want to persuade people in that way. So I do keep it, my own faith, pretty personal, and it's complicated. And my partner, Amy, and I, we share this together, but it's not something that I share with students or really in the adult education realm either.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like a very good psychotherapist too, being able to kind of keep that so people have room to grow in your presence and not feel directed by it, because you're not a guru, you're a professor. So there's two different.
Yeah, and I like to keep those roles really important. Is one of the things I tell my students is my role is not to persuade or dissuade you towards any particular position, and that's religious, politics, or anything else. All I want them to be at the end of the quarter is a more thoughtful person, to be a more reflective person. And if that leads you to convert to Tibetan Buddhism, fantastic. If that leads you to be an atheist, fantastic. I just want you to be thoughtful in whatever they do. And to be, you know, to make these important life decisions based on knowledge, not what I heard on such and such show or what I heard on, you know, what I saw on some website. And so to be a good consumer of religion, to understand these important questions, that's all I want. Because there are tons of people out there in the world who are trying to tell them what to believe and what not to believe. And that's not my role. My role is to arm them with knowledge, to help them think through whatever they're thinking through, and not to have a stake in the outcome.
If you're just tuning in, this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. My guest today is Dr. Stephen Lloyd Moffatt. He's a professor of religious studies at Cal Poly. And I asked him in because I am of the religious curious. And so I wanted to pick his brain about religion. And was it a truism that my students said that you ask of them to believe something, that there's an importance in believing something?
Yeah, I mean, I don't remember those exact words, but I do think that that there's a couple of ways to take that I think are both important. The first is, I think you see a lot of sort of spiritual voyeurism right now, where people want to have a sort of spiritual bucket list that is akin to their you know, vacation bucket list. And so, oh, I want to go chant with the Tibetan monks, and I want to do the pilgrimage at Compostela. I want to, you know, have mass at the Vatican. And there is a certain value to that. And I get taking a sort of life survey of religion, there is a value to that. But I think the most interesting things happen in the depths of religion. And I think having a sort of superficial, I check that box, doesn't provide for true spiritual development. And so I encourage people to sort of, you know, find something that's meaningful to them and really explore all the depths of it. And that I can't tell you what that tradition is going to be. And one of the things I tell students is that I think every religion makes sense if you accept certain premises. A religious tradition that has lasted thousands of years and given meaning to billions of people over the years is not irrational. there's some way it makes sense. And yes, individual religious people can be crazy. The wacko from Waco, David Koresh, the guy's nuts. But I don't think traditions as a whole are ever inconsistent or irrational. And so you really have to auger down and figure out what is those base understandings of the human person and of the world and the spirit world, and how do those base understandings inform the more developed theology? Because I think for a lot of people, you know, they see different religious forms and they're like, oh, that's crazy. Oh, that doesn't make any sense. And I'm with them. I mean, you know, I distinctly remember the first time I went to a mosque and everybody was bowing. And my first thought was, oh, somebody dropped a contact. I mean, it's just, we do, unfamiliar things are scary to us. But I think they do make sense. And so you kind of have to understand what that linchpin is. Mm-hmm. You know, what's the leap of faith? Because I think each tradition has a leap of faith. And if you can understand that and make that leap of faith, then everything builds off it. So, for example, in Christianity, the leap of faith is the resurrection. If the resurrection happened, Christianity all makes sense. If the resurrection didn't happen, it doesn't make sense. And that's the Apostle Paul talking, not me talking. For Buddhism, it's, did Siddhartha obtain enlightenment under that tree? If he did, we should all be Buddhists. If he didn't, well, there's no reason to. For Islam, it's the Quran is the pure, direct, and unadulterated word of God. If that is right, then we should all trust the Quran. If that's not right, then nobody should. For Judaism, it's the Sinai event. If that happened, all of it makes sense. And so each of these has a kind of linchpin, and that's the leap of faith that people take. And then once you take that leap of faith, everything is consistently built up from that. And so all religions make sense. That doesn't mean all religions are true.
Okay.
It could mean that there are false, like there are false premises, but it does mean that they're rationally consistent. And I think our instinct for a lot of us is to dismiss things that, oh, that's crazy. I wouldn't make sense. And I encourage the students to try to understand them and to make sense. And so when I talk about that, you know, believe in something, I think one of the things I mean by that is, hey, here's these religions have deep, longstanding, meaningful stories, practices, beliefs. And so oftentimes, if you're just sort of being a voyeur of them, you miss all the interesting stuff. And I remember when I was back up on Mount Athos and they're Eastern Orthodox, mostly Greek Orthodox Christians there. And they have a very mystical practice called the prayer of the heart, where the idea is you pray out loud and then eventually it comes into your biorhythms. Super interesting practice. And I remember I went to a hermit and we were talking and I said, teach me the prayer of the heart. And he says, repeat for me the Nicene Creed in Greek. And I said, I don't even know the Nicene Creed. And he goes, memorize that, contemplate that for a couple of years, and then you can ask me a question. And what I realized in retrospect, what he was doing was saying, look, understand the faith, and then you can get instructions on some of the deepest elements to it. And I think that takes time and commitment and a real longing from the heart to do that. And I think for a lot of people, it's no, I want the prayer of the heart without the Christianity that supports it.
Right, a little. Well, in our culture, that's 30-minute segments or now five-minute mm-hmm. segments. I would think the idea of diving into any sort of practice in a deep way would feel like waste of time for people who have said, yeah. But what about another shiny object? And if I put 3 years mm-hmm. into this religion and then it isn't the truth for me, yeah. I lost 3 years. You know, how do we keep people in this modern era where there's so many distractions? Because I imagine 1,000 years ago, you had a lot more time to do the prayer of the heart.
Yeah, there's certainly a rush to, I want to feel something. Mm-hmm. And if I don't feel something, I'll abandon it. There's that old saying, it's better to dig one deep well than five shallow wells. And I think in the end, that's right, even if the deep well takes more time. And I think, I mean, you know this probably better than anyone, that our mind doesn't flip. It evolves, mm-hmm. it grows, And I think so much of the wisdom of the spiritual traditions, we kind of have to marinate it in it a bit to allow it to subtly change how we think. You know, the idea that you're just going to have a equivalent of a cliff top experience and you're going to be transformed in a second. I don't think the spiritual traditions speak to that kind of experience very often. Sometimes you do, but.
But although you had that moment that piqued your something inside of you, right? Something had to open up for you to even want to.
Yeah, I think we all have those moments of inspiration. Mm-hmm. But those are the starts of the journey, not the ends of the journey. And, you know, it's funny when I teach, and you know this in the classroom as well, I never really know what is going to be the sentence that changes people. But in almost every class, somebody stops taking notes, puts their pen down, and you can just see them go, huh. And those are the meaningful moments. And those are the ones that, you know, people, you know, years later, and students write all the time, they're like, hey, when you said this, and I was like, I don't remember saying that, but anyhow.
Sometimes I'm afraid of the thing they might take away.
Yeah, and sometimes it goes in weird directions. But I think, you know, you need something to inspire you in a direction. Mm-hmm. And usually those things are not anticipated. You have a conversation, you know, with somebody and they introduce you to a person or a song or a idea or a practice. And that clicks with people and then you're off. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a certain value to really dedicating yourself to that and understanding it. I think the other side of that too is this community element. I see, you know, there's one trend in religion right now, which I've alternately called like salad bar playlist, but it's basically like this. Is I always get surprised at salad bars about what people put together. You know, it's like jalapeno peppers, cottage cheese, and croutons. Like that's a salad. And what's interesting is each person sits in front of a salad bar and says, what do I feel like today? Especially if it's one of those like, you know, Lassen's or, you know, where you've got not just salad, but you've got, you know, entire food cultures there.
And
And you put it all, you put it all together and most people don't pile it, you know, you kind of put corners and, you know, you put stuff together. And I think for a lot of people, religion has become like a salad bar to them. And so they sit and say, okay, what do I need right now? Well, I'm at a stressful part in my life. Some meditation practice that I'm going to do from centering prayer will help. I really like this idea of being able to physically develop and spiritually develop. I'm going to start doing yoga. I'm distrustful of Western medicine, so I'm going to base myself on traditional Chinese medicine. And I'm still going to go to Christmas and Easter with my family. And what I think is fascinating about that is there's very little attempt to reconcile those various positions and traditions. But you're essentially saying, what do I need? And how does that get fulfilled? And I think for a lot of people in society, that's a meaningful way to go through life because they find in various religious traditions something they can't find in a single one. And they find support in the same way we've got friends who play different roles. You know, we have our workout buddies. We've got our party friends. We've got our people we have deep conversations with. But we have multiple friends. We don't bring them together very often. And oftentimes when we do bring them together, it's really
not
awkward.
Good.
Yeah. You know, graduations or weddings or whatever. It's like, oh, yeah. And so I think there's a certain value to a salad bar approach. But the one thing it forfeits is community because no two people have the same spiritual salad bar. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the most meaningful elements of religion is community. Both in the facet of you have a group to support you, but also, you know, some of the most meaningful spiritual experiences happen together, you know, whether you're praying together or singing together or even just hiking together. And I think forfeiting community is one of the real challenges in the evolution of certain forms of spirituality today.
And it's also in our mental health and well-being as individuals that we forfeited connection on all levels, religious and familial and friends. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. My guest today is Dr. Stephen Lloyd Moffatt, professor, religious studies professor, and program director of the religious studies minor at Cal Poly, and we're kind of wandering through the minefield of religious conversations, and we are going to open up the phone lines for you as well. 805-781-3875 is the number to be part of our conversation. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. We'll be back to take your calls.
Day by day, oh dear Lord, three things I pray: to see Thee more clearly, love Thee more dearly, follow Thee more nearly, day by day, day by day.
Listening to A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. Our number is 805-781-3875 if you have a question or comment for Dr. Stephen Lloyd Moffatt. And we would love to join you or have you join us in wherever we go. I have so many questions. This is the thing that keeps popping up for me as you're talking is there are a lot of religious traditions. Is there something that links all of these traditions together? Is there a commonality that you see from tradition to tradition and beliefs?
Yeah, I mean, there have been a lot of attempts to find that, some sort of universalism from like perennial philosophy with Aldous Huxley to theosophy, which 19th century imagined a meta-religion that brings it all together dedicated to truth. I think that there is some common questions that guide religions. You know, who are you? Why do we exist? What happens to us when we die? Why should I be good? Why do good things happen to bad people and bad things happen to good people? So I think there's some common basic questions. But religions have different answers to those, and they're grounded in specific cultural contexts. And so oftentimes a sort of search for a universality in them ends up erasing those specific contexts and, you know, starts saying, oh, okay, I know you believe it, but that's not important because this part coincides with this other part. And you kind of end up in this position of an almost colonist saying, here's what your religion really says. So I kind of am reluctant to try to sort of combine everything. I think there are families of religions that have common responses. So the Abrahamic family, you've got Judaism, Christianity, Islam, and Baha'i. And these are traditions that tend to have common questions like, why is there sin? What happens to us when we die? They tend to have a lineal view of the world. They tend to think that God reveals himself in Revelation. So there's kind of a commonality series of questions. There's the Vedic traditions or Indian traditions, so Hinduism, Buddhism, Jainism, that their big questions are really like, who am I and what is real? And so they have a sort of common set of questions and different answers. Then there's the Chinese traditions, which tend to have questions around harmony, like how do we find harmony between nature, between society, and the spirit world? And so they have a common set of questions they deal with. So I'm more comfortable sort of finding commonalities within families than across, because oftentimes I think it kind of erases the distinctiveness of each tradition.
Do Is there a need for a modern-day religion then? Because you talked about how if these traditions are thousands of years old, then there must be some value in something that can withstand the test of time and the importance of the historical context of what was happening when these religions emerged. But here we are thousands of years later. Is there not then a need for another contextual understanding of religion?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I would say that all religions are constantly changing. You know, there is no essence that is unchanging throughout a tradition. I mean, if any Christian from the first century walked in any church in America, they would be completely lost and misunderstood. Even 50 years ago, maybe 60 years ago, there was not a church in America that had a guitar. And now it's almost presumed to have, you know, contemporary music. Religions are just constantly changing and adapting. And, you know, one of the reasons why Christianity is the biggest religion in the world is because it's so well at adapting to different traditions. I mean, if you look at even the personal relationship Christians, which are kind of the growth area, these are mega churches that stress personal relationship. You know, they basically co-opted the whole hippie message, you know, love, don't talk about sin, express yourself, individuality, you know, you've got a friend in Jesus. So, I mean, they co-opted. And so one of the reasons why Christianity thrived in the 70s, 80s, 90s, and up to the present time is because it took what was popular in society, that is that message of the 60s, and mapped it onto to the Christian message. And so religions are always shifting. And there's always new religious movements that try to capture the geist of the moment. So, you know, Scientology really thought it was that way for the 60s and 70s, and maybe for the future. But, I mean, there are always new evolutions that are responding. And I think, you know, if a religion's not changing, it's dead, and it's not going to find many followers. Because if you aren't speaking to contemporary issues in some way, you're going to lose the interest of people.
My guest is Dr. Stephen Lloyd Moffatt. Our number is 805-781-3875. Hi, Ted. You're on the air. What's on your mind today? Oh, I don't hear Ted.
Hi, excuse me. I'm right here.
Hi, Ted.
Hello.
What's on your mind today?
Okay. I was struck by the professor's comment that all
Ted, I'm gonna ask you to call me back because our line is not strong. So please give us a call back. But I think I'm hearing him say something about the all religions are based on some
a
part of
faith.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I think we often in the polemics between religious traditions, there's often sort of the argument that we're rational. We're only responding to how the world is. And I kind of want to get students away from this competition of which one's rational and which one's not, because I can make a case for almost any religious tradition about how it has provided meaning. I know them well enough to be able to do so. And so I think trying to sort of posit, one's rational, one's irrational, one's based on evidence and one's based not on evidence, I don't think is super productive. And I mean, going back to your original statement at the beginning of the show, you talked about how when people who like to share their faith don't feel like they're trying to convert people. I think what they see themselves is just sharing the truth. And so I'm not trying to convert you. I'm just trying to, you know, illumine the world to you. And so they don't see it as I really want to like force you to believe what I believe. What they're trying to do is share good things. And the word evangelize in Greek just means to share good news. And humans are evangelistic. I mean, when we find a new product, Beyond Meat, we tell everybody, go eat it. We're evangelists of it. Every time we find a new show or a new restaurant, we're evangelists. And so people like to share good things with others. And so I think when you have people of particular religious views where they have proved meaningful to them, they're evangelizing, but they don't see it as I'm trying to coerce you into becoming this tradition. I just want to share something exciting in my life. And that tends to be it. Yeah, the good news. Yeah.
Let's try Ted again. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
All right, that's a clear signal. Tell me, what's on your mind?
Okay, I just had a quick thought that I heard the professor discussing the idea that all religious traditions were based on a leap of faith, in essence. And my experience is, in my spiritual experience, is that it has more to do with experience than belief. I'd like to suggest I have a meditation practice that could be said to come out of Buddhism or perhaps Hinduism, but it's the practice, it is the experience of it that I've found meaningful, and nothing involving actually what you might call faith or belief, but pure experience. And that that's what I have found, and that was really the only thing I had to say.
Thank you, Ted. All right, so
yeah, well, Ted, I think you're actually right in the sense of, even when you look at studies, when people choose a particular religious orientation, it is usually because of an experience they have. It's usually not that they rationally, you know, went across a religious tradition and say which one is most rationally consistent. Very few people choose a spiritual path based on, you know, rational decision choice theory or something like that. Usually they had experience. I tried meditating and it was wonderful. I'm going to keep doing it. I think what I was trying to say earlier was more to the point that when you talk about various religious traditions, I think this idea that they have certain premises by which they fundamentally see the world and they build upon those premises, and when and in a rationally consistent way, the challenge is those premises usually don't have the kinds of evidence that would be able to persuade an unbiased person. They are leaps of faith that can't be proven either way. Did the Buddha attain enlightenment under that tree? I don't know what kind of evidence we could muster that would convince somebody who wasn't biased one way or the other in it. And so if you choose to embrace this Buddhist worldview, you aren't enlightened at the beginning. That's the whole point. And so you trust that what the Buddha wants to share to the world is something that will be meaningful to me. I won't be able to prove in a way that will convince people who are unbiased whether Jesus resurrected or not. If you want to embrace that story, you will grow in your faith. But you've got to embrace that premise in order to start.
Is it a bit like falling in love?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a lot of things in religion where our mind catches up with our heart. And so in the same way you fall in love and then you figure out, wow, why were we attracted to one another?
Right. What was that spark?
I think it's there is parallels there, that we get drawn to something by an instinct, a feeling, an experience, Ted, maybe if that's the term you want to use. Mm-hmm. And then we backfill the intellectual justification to say, here's why it makes sense. So I think, yeah.
Well, I was just saying, also love requires that we overlook a lot of things about our partner and our beloved that other people might say, don't you see that?
Yeah, so many conversations you have on religion, especially, you know, with some traditions that have some less traditional beliefs, you go to the people, wait, you know, you're going to get your own planet, or the fact is, most people, that's not why they join these traditions. You know, you get these argumentative religious types who be like, what about this belief, or what about this verse, or what about that action in 1420 or whatever? And, you know, there's the person meditating, and Buddhism is like, I just know that it helps me and I like the community. I think there is this sort of there's a religious modality of people who like to be argumentative, and many of them become religious studies minors. But I think that's divorced from a lot of the reality of people, which is, why am I drawn to this? I had an experience. I met these people. it's playing a positive role in my life. I want what that person has.
You're listening to Dr. Stephen Lloyd Moffitt, professor at Cal Poly and Religious Studies. Our number is 805-781-3875. Sean, what's on your mind today?
People who have mental illnesses quite a bit, and some of them I just wonder because they're hearing God or they're hearing Satan or whatever, and I wonder to what extent we bear responsibility, or religious folks bear responsibility for putting forth the idea, you know, yeah, there's demons flying all over the place, and there's a lake of fire under the ground, and there's a big biker guy in the sky that's throwing plates at your head, and yeah, they talk in your head, make you do evil things. And I wonder, if we get some comfort off of religion, don't we also bear responsibility for bringing that kind of negativity and encouraging this sort of negative delusion that leads to these things and war and other things like that? I'm just wondering, does the positive outweigh the negative socially?
All right. Thank you, Sean. So I think the question is, how much responsibility do we have for the energy that is surrounding religious practices?
Yeah, I mean, I think most broadly speaking, any religious or spiritual tradition has the potential to be violent, to be negative. I mean, one of the things I like to point out historically, it's the Buddhist who invented suicide bombing in Sri Lanka. It's the Buddhists right now who are, doing the worst oppression in the world of Muslims and the Rohingya. And yet, the Buddhists also inspire the Dalai Lama every day to preach love and acceptance of all traditions. And so every religious tradition has potential to be violent or nonviolent. Every religious tradition has a potential to inspire goodness or to inspire hate. And the line is in each individual's human heart. And, whether you want to use your religious tradition to encourage goodness and hope, or do you want to use this religious tradition to inspire hate or division? Because any religious tradition can be used for that. I would say net-net, I think religion is a positive thing. I mean, I was at a dinner party and got in a discussion with a evangelical militant atheist on it, and she was opposed to all religious traditions. And she said, religion's killed so many people. I said, well, I mean, I think people have killed people. They always have. Religion may have been a justification. She said, atheism has never killed anyone. And I was like, well, what about the Soviet Union or Pol Pot or eugenics or all these atheist-inspired things? She goes, oh, they're not true atheists because true atheists wouldn't kill it. And, you got to own all parts of your tradition because I think many Christians would say true Christians wouldn't have done the Inquisition. They wouldn't, true Christians would not have persecuted people over time. And so, every religious tradition and a religious traditions, such as atheism, have the potential for good and bad. And so I think our role is to encourage the good. And I would say that's true of secular positions as well. I mean, certainly there's lots of political and philosophical positions that could be used negatively, and just like religion can be. And so I think we have a responsibility to find the goodness in our traditions, to share the goodness in our traditions, and inspire other people.
Well, what about Sean's point of demons and negative energies that are unleashed around the planet? How does that play into religious traditions?
I think, historically speaking, we can say that a lot of what gets put on demons and things are just earlier forms of trying to understand mental challenges. Not to say that there aren't evil forces in the universe. There probably is. I've seen lots of weird things that I can't explain, but I think a lot of it has been an attempt to give language to things that are universally human, which in mental illness is. I think my next research project is actually on this. How do you tell the difference between somebody having a mystical experience and seeing angels versus the guy, at farmer's market who claims to be seeing angels. Most people will sort of instinctively dismiss the farmer's market person as someone who is has some mental challenges in front of them, and not dismiss the person who spent 30 years in a monastery. But I'm trying to think through, like, how do we know? How can we tell what is, you know, authentic or inauthentic, or what? How can we tell with these extreme spiritual experiences?
Well, it's interesting because in the mental health world, I've always found it fascinating that when people hear voices or they're delusional, it's generally related to some sort of religious voices they're hearing. Or so it's probably too big of a topic to bring up at the very last minute we have together, but I think it's something we should continue on to another conversation if you're up for it.
Yeah, sure.
All right. So we're going to pull it together here at this moment, but we are going to continue this conversation and offer it up to you in the next couple of weeks. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this has been A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. My guest today was Dr. Stephen Lloyd Moffatt, Professor of Religious Studies and Program Director of the Religious Studies Minor at Cal Poly. You can get in touch with me by sending me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com or through Facebook, The Reluctant Therapist, or follow me on Instagram, elizabeth_TRT. This show and all previous shows will be available at kcbx.org under the News Talk tab, and you can podcast our show to share with others. As always, I appreciate you being a part of our conversation. I look forward to speaking to you next Tuesday. Thank you for supporting Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
Let's give God the praise. Anybody can know that it's worthy. I wish I had a house here. Anybody can know God is worthy to be praised. I'm getting ready to dance. I told him I was gonna get my feet done. I didn't get them done, but I'm still ready to dance. I want you to listen while we sing this song. Listen.
I hear the sound like the sound of a trumpet.
Trumpet.
I hear the sound. Like the sound of many waters.
Many waters.
Make me feel so good inside to know God about. I know
Jesus.
He's calling me.
He's calling me.
I know that
Jesus.
He's calling me.
He's calling.
He's calling. Come on, put your hand together. Come on. Let's have some service out of here. It takes control and it won't let go.
Won't let go.
Make me feel so good inside to know. God of I don't know.
Jesus.
He laid his hand on
he
me.
Laid his hand on me.
One Friday.
Jesus.
He laid
his hand.
Oh! He laid his hand on. I wish I had a witness hand. When I see my neighbor now, I have a desire to treat him right.
Treat him right.
I compare my friends to my neighbors. I found that I can love them. My life has been changed.